All right. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. So, thank you so much. It's a pretty exciting time in my life. I just found out just a little while ago that my children's book, Johnny the Walrus, is now the number one best-selling children's book, or actually book, period, on Amazon out of all books. Thank you. And, you know, it's for those who aren't familiar, it's a board book for preschoolers about a child who identifies as a walrus. And I think I can now say that it's the best-selling walrus-related children's book of all time, I think. So I'm excited about that. And I'm even more excited because Amazon was very upset about this, and they were doing things to kind of stifle the book, and they took our ads down, and they did all these things, and the Amazon employees were crying, and were talking about how traumatized they are by it. And after that is when it's best-selling on Amazon, so I just think that's fantastic. I want to thank you all for being here tonight. I want to thank you especially for having the bravery and courage to expose yourself to my harmful, dangerous, traumatic opinions. I know it's not easy for you. It's not easy for either of us. You know, if it's hurtful for you to hear my opinions, think about how it is for me. I have to say them, so it's even harder for me. In fact, some videos leaked yesterday showing a meeting that leftist activists on this campus had with university administrators recently. And the activists wanted to shut down the speech, but they weren't able to do that, so the administrators instead were helping them game plan a protest, because this is the kind of privilege you have as a leftist on a college campus. University officials will meet with you and console you and help you organize a protest against speakers you don't like. And they're out there right now, and in fact, it was kind of nice. They're protesting right now, and I looked out the window, I saw them, and they were having, they got pizza for themselves, so my producer went out and got me a slice of pizza. So I had a nice little snack. I appreciate that. And for the protesters, you know, feeding a best-selling children's author is an act of charity, I think. Now, and, you know, some of these activists were complaining. One of them said that this was the most exhausting time of his life, which means that you've led a very privileged life, if me coming to speak is your most exhausting experience. As a father of four, I have, like, 10 experiences a day that are more exhausting than this speech. And I'm the one, again, giving the speech. Now, it may be funny to laugh at leftists who panic over opposing ideas. And it is funny. You know, hilarious. But there's a reason they react this way. The reason is that they're protecting, guarding a worldview which cannot hold up against even the slightest scrutiny. And at some level, they realize this, which is why they desperately guard themselves against exposure to contrary viewpoints. This is also why they're in the midst of a nuclear meltdown over Elon Musk buying Twitter. You know, they're afraid that Musk will make good on his promise to allow everyone to basically speak freely, and this will make Twitter unsafe, they say. And what they mean is that it will be psychologically unsafe because there will be potential landmines all over the place threatening to explode their whole fragile, flimsy, shoddily constructed, duct-taped together worldview. A slight breeze can knock the whole Jenga tower down, and they know it. And that terrifies them. And nowhere, in no ideological arena, is that more true than in the arena of gender. Now, we know that left-wing gender ideology teaches, of course, that gender is fluid and socially constructed. Anybody who feels like a man, whatever that means, really is one. And anyone who feels like a woman, whatever that means, really is that. Now, this is false. It bears no relation to the truth. It doesn't make it within 100 miles of the vicinity of the truth. And it can easily be exposed as a falsehood, an incoherent jumble of nonsense. And that can be done just by asking a few basic questions. One of the most basic questions to the person who says that men can be women is, and this is the question I've been asking for a long time, I even have a film about it, is what is a woman? Like, what do you mean when you use that word? What are you trying to say? They can't answer that question or any other question, yet this ideology has taken over the culture. It can't withstand scrutiny. It crumbles immediately under the most mild interrogation, and yet it has had enormous cultural success. So what I'd like to do for the rest of the talk tonight is examine why and how it has achieved this success. I think there are three areas, three sort of strategies which have allowed them to accomplish this. The first is language. Okay, the trans agenda has infiltrated our society largely through language, and I don't mean that the gender ideologues use language to make compelling arguments. Not at all. Rather, they manipulate language itself. They make it into their pet. They talk about preferred pronouns, but a pronoun is a grammatical construct. It has to be deployed according to the laws of grammar, not the fickle whims of the individual to whom it refers. You know, if I'm standing on this stage and you want to communicate to somebody else about the fact that I am standing on this stage, you will say, he is standing on that stage. It would be grammatically and factually incorrect, to say she is standing on that stage, as she denotes a human female, which I am not. It would be incorrect to say they are standing on the stage, as that indicates more than one person on the stage, which there is not. It would be incorrect to say Z or Zer is standing on the stage, as that would seem to suggest that there's some sort of space alien on the stage, which, as far as you know, I am not. In a similar way, if I'm standing on a stage and I insist that my preferred preposition is off, it would make no sense for you to respect my preferences and tell everybody that I'm standing off the stage. Now, I may prefer the word off. I may think that I am off the stage. I may identify as somebody who's standing off the stage. But that doesn't change the objective fact that I am indeed on the stage. Prepositions, nouns, and pronouns, and verbs, I mean, unless they're used in a fictional story or poem or something, are usually meant to convey objective facts about reality. If they're not going to perform that function, then they no longer perform any function at all, and meaningful, useful words have been reduced to impotent nonsense. But shouldn't we just be polite and call people by their preferred pronouns anyway? Because it's the nice thing to do. Well, answer no, and here's why. First, you don't generally call somebody a pronoun when you're speaking to them. If you want to address a person directly, you just use his or her name. And a name can be whatever you want it to be. I mean, if a woman says her name is Fred, or a man says his name is Sally, I'll call her Fred and him Sally, because names are, by definition, personal, basically arbitrary. Pronouns are objective and also generally more distant. You're usually called by a pronoun when you're not physically present for the discussion. So when somebody insists on a preferred pronoun, he's trying to prevent you from using proper grammar even when he's not in the room with you. He's saying, whenever you refer to me, even if I'm 10,000 miles away, you must abandon the rules of grammar and parrot whatever gibberish I assign to you. That's not only absurd, it's arrogant in the extreme. He's trying to control what you say about him when he's not even in the room. That's not how language works. That's not how grammar works. That's not how life works. It's not my job to enforce your self-perception. So you might see yourself as a woman, but that's not how I see you. And that's not what you actually are. And so I can't be required to affirm what I don't believe and what I know to be untrue. And further, it's not my job to adopt your perception of yourself. How crazy is it that this is what people think, and that so many people just accept it? You know, as I explained on Dr. Phil, I might perceive myself as handsome and brilliant. Please don't laugh at that. But I said, please don't laugh. But I can't require that everybody who speaks about me also have that same perception. I can't say to you, well, I see myself this way, and so you have to see me that way. Again, that's just simply not how it works. My self-perception is not a project that the whole world has to take on. That's why we call it self-perception. Second point, using an incorrect pronoun, incorrect as in a pronoun that doesn't properly convey objective reality, is not only nonsensical, but it's also dishonest. So if I say, she drove to the store, when I'm really talking about a man driving to the store, I'm lying. Now, I may be lying with the best intentions, but a lie is a lie. I am conveying an untruth. It's bad to convey untruths because the person I'm speaking to, whoever it is, deserves to know the truth. And if I don't think they deserve to know the truth, then I shouldn't be saying anything to them at all. And also, the person I'm referring to deserves the truth, which is why if I'm talking directly to that person, I'm also going to use the correct pronoun. A confused and deluded person needs the truth. He doesn't need us to participate in and encourage his delusion. That might be what he thinks he wants, but it's not what he needs. It's not going to help him in the long run. But doesn't grammar and language evolve over time? That's the other thing you always hear. Well, it does. However, language evolves according to coherent rules and standards. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people making up their own rules individually, which isn't evolution. That's just the collapse of language. In order for language to work, there have to be shared rules that we all understand and agree to, and that makes sense. If you don't have that, then there's no way to communicate. Language is a symbol. You know, it's a sound that's meant to represent something. So we say elephant to talk about elephants, camels to talk about camels. Things could have worked out so that we say camels to talk about the animals that we now think of as elephants and vice versa. There's no reason why we had to use those particular sounds to represent those animals. That's just how it worked out. That's why language can shift and change over time. But changes in language happen organically. At least that's what's supposed to happen. Due to a wide combination of influences, people begin to slightly adjust the verbal symbols they use for certain things, and eventually the official grammatical rules as written in grammar textbooks will change also. But they change descriptively, not proscriptively. They're describing and codifying a change that's already underway. What's happening with pronouns is not like this at all. This is a top-down change. The grammar rules are being changed proscriptively. Our cultural elites have decided for ideological reasons that we ought to be using different words, and they are berating and scolding and punishing us until we comply. That is not evolution of language. This is an intentional manipulation of language, which is a very different thing. Just look at what they're doing with the made-up nonsensical word Latinx, or Latinx, however you pronounce it. Nobody in the Hispanic community uses that word or likes it, and yet the cultural elites keep using it and pushing it and pushing it, hoping that eventually people will submit and just start adopting it in daily use. If and when that day happens, they'll then turn around and say, well, look at that, language evolved. But calling that natural evolution, it's like injecting drugs into a lab rat and calling it natural evolution when it grows a third ear. That's not natural. Now, the other strategy, very much related and connected to the first, is to sow confusion. This is the other way that gender ideology takes hold of our society. It's to make the issue of sex and gender seem complicated, complex, the sort of thing that you have to rely on the experts to explain to you. And conveniently, the experts are all leftists, and most of them are paid off by the pharmaceutical companies who are making billions of dollars off of the gender confusion epidemic. The refusal to define the word woman is part of this. Now, they say that nobody can define it. It's an abstract philosophical concept. Doesn't mean anything, really, they say. And although it doesn't mean anything, they still want you to take a man seriously when he says he identifies as a woman, despite the fact that he's identifying as something that, according to them, means nothing. But none of this makes sense or is true. The word woman, just like the word man, has a definition. A woman, by definition, is an adult human female. A man is an adult human male. Those are the only two options available for the human species. That's it. There is no third sex. Doesn't exist. All humans who have ever lived have been either male or female. What do we call this? We call this a binary system. It's the only system available to us. It's the reason why, if you go on Amazon and you order a shirt with the non-binary pride flag, it will come in either men's or women's sizes. Because there's no other third option. Now, what is a female? Well, a female is somebody with XX chromosomes, a female reproductive system, female gametes or eggs, and the ability in principle to ovulate and bear offspring. Now, there are females who suffer from illnesses, mutations, injuries, deformities, or who simply are postmenopausal, which prevent them from performing some of these natural female functions. That does not make them any less female, and it also does nothing at all to invalidate the binary. It is instead what we call an exception that proves the rule. Here's why. When a female cannot bear children, we know that something is wrong physically. And we know this because females are supposed to be able to bear children. When a man cannot bear children, we know that it is not a sign of anything having gone wrong, because men are not supposed to be able to bear children and never ever have. So if as a woman, you go to the doctor and tell him that you're unable to conceive children in your womb, he's not going to say to you, oh, well, maybe that means that you're non-binary. Maybe that's just who you are. That's just how it is. You'd probably be pretty upset if he said that. No, he's going to run some tests and he's going to figure out what's wrong in your body. Maybe it can be fixed, maybe it can't. But it's just a fact that something is wrong and he can almost certainly find out what it is. If as a man you go to the doctor and tell him that you're unable to conceive children in your womb, he'll run some tests to see what's wrong with your mind. Or at least that's how he would have responded up until recently. Now, because society has lost its mind, he might give the man hormone pills to help him transition into a woman. But you'll note that even after transition, still the man will not be able to ovulate or conceive children or perform any other exclusively female function because he's not a female and will never be one. He's a man. That means he's a male with XX chromosomes, a male anatomy, male gametes. But XY chromosomes. Sorry, there we go. But there's a lot more to being a male than just that. Indeed, the physical differences between men and women are not confined to the reproductive system. They can be found in every bodily system, in every part of the body. A man is male down to his bones, down to his cells, down to his DNA. Even after he dies, his bones will attest to the biological reality. They can dig him up 100 years from now and find his bones and find out that he was male. The bones will not declare his pronouns or affirm his self-perception. There will be no self. The self is gone, but the man remains. Now, many of these biological differences, by the way, happen to give him a distinct advantage over women in sports. Differences like that account for the fact that women have 20% less muscle mass on average than men, 40% less upper body strength, 33% less lower body strength, smaller fast twitch muscle fibers, smaller lungs, smaller hearts, shorter legs, more estrogen, less testosterone, a lower capacity to produce oxygen when they exert themselves. These advantages are why the fastest man in the world is always faster than the fastest woman. And if the fastest man dies, the next fastest will be faster than the fastest woman. In fact, if the 100 fastest men all got on a plane to go to a fastest man retreat, and the plane crashed and they all died, the 101st fastest man, who's now fastest by inheritance, will still be faster than the fastest woman. And then the next 100 could get on a plane, and they can all die too, because they didn't learn their lesson from the first batch. And whatever man remains, he's now faster than the fastest woman. There has never been a time, and the Olympics attest to this, there's never been a time, not ever, not once, when the women's racing or swimming champions were faster on average than the men in the Olympics. It has never happened ever in history and never will. These advantages are why there's a whole website dedicated to comparing high school boys' track and field champions against female Olympians. The high school boys outperform the female Olympians in almost every category by huge margins. So take one example. The New Balance Nationals Outdoor Meet is one of the preeminent high school track meets in the country. If the 2016 high school boys finalists in the 100 meters were to have raced against the 2016 female Olympic finalists, the fastest woman would have come in 9th place against high school boys. Gold, silver, bronze in places 4 through 8 would all be held by high school boys against female Olympians. This holds true in almost every event. And it's not just track and it's not just hypothetical. Back in 2017, a soccer team, the U.S. women's national soccer team, scrimmaged against 15-year-old boys and lost 5-2. Male and female athletes are so different, separated by such a vast biological chasm, that you can actually count the total number of dunks made by WNBA players in the history of the league. Total. And that number is 28. 23 of them were by the same player. By contrast, there's a player in the NBA who dunked the ball 300 times by himself in one season. So that's one player in 1 year dunking it almost 10 times more than the entire WNBA over the course of a quarter century. Men and women are different, a lot different. Men are stronger, they're faster, they're better at almost every competitive sport. Literally every line of evidence supports this. All of the evidence, all of it, supports the claim that men in general have biological advantages over women in sports. There is no evidence going the other way, which is why the gender ideologues on that side do not produce evidence. They have none to produce. They cannot defend their position. And because they can't defend their position, that motivates them even more to employ the third and final strategy, and the one with the greatest consequence for our civilization. That is to indoctrinate very young children. And as far as they're concerned, the younger the better. They're succeeding. A Gallup survey recently showed that the number of trans-identifying people in Gen Z is 10 times higher than older generations. 20% of Gen Z identifies as LGBT. That's double millennials. And millennial LGBT identification is double the boomers. And boomers are double their parents' generation. So the LGBT camp has doubled in size with every successive generation since 1940. That's not an accident. And it doesn't even include my own kids' generation, where the numbers will no doubt be far more dramatic. My kids' generation are really the first to have these ideas foisted on them practically since birth. And that's how we so commonly hear now about 3- and 4-year-old kids who identify, quote unquote, as the opposite gender. Now, the idea that a child can choose his gender is indefensible, and would still be indefensible even if the broader claims of left-wing gender theory were true, which they aren't. As the parent, like I said, of 4 kids, one of them currently 5 years old, I can tell you that a 4- or 5-year-old child can't reliably make any choice in any context, period. Take a 4-year-old child to Baskin-Robbins and ask him to pick which flavor he prefers, and he'll give you 14 different answers before collapsing into tears. He cannot make that decision. There are parents who, at restaurants, the waiter comes up, and they'll sit there and they'll ask their 4-year-old, well, what would you like to eat from the kids' menu? Here's 5 options. And the waiter's going to stand there for 45 minutes while the kid debates it. I've been through this with my own kid. I recently was at a restaurant, and I made this mistake. I don't know why I made it, but it was a rookie mistake. And I asked my son, well, what would you like to eat? And he told me that he wants to eat salmon. And I said, you don't want to eat salmon. You don't even know what that is. What are you talking about? I know better than you do what you want to eat. Why did I even ask? That's the way it goes with kids. A child that age has not developed the cognitive ability to assess a variety of options and decide which course is correct, healthy, safe, sensible. He will not have that ability for many years. He certainly won't have it when he's 12, which is the age when so many kids now are choosing, quote unquote, to be chemically castrated and sterilized, forever foreclosing the opportunity to have children in the future. They are, quote, deciding to give up on reproducing and to give up on so much else at an age where, in any other context, we would all agree they're not equipped to make practically any choice at all. The prefrontal cortex in the brain, which controls our long-term planning and discernment, isn't fully online until the age of 25. We have kids half that age, younger than half that age, who are making life-altering, lifelong decisions. Decisions that their adult versions of themselves will have to live with forever. Until tragically so many of them kill themselves, because that's the path that we're putting these kids on. Now, of course, nobody can choose his or her own sex. That matter is irrevocably settled by our chromosomes and reproductive organs. But the leftist position here is so preposterous that even if one grants the premise that gender can theoretically be chosen, the left would still be wrong in thinking that 4-year-olds or 12-year-olds can choose it. There's a reason why young children are not entrusted with any legal powers or responsibilities. They can't vote, drive, take out a mortgage, buy a gun, buy a ticket for an R-rated movie, buy alcohol, buy cigarettes, buy practically anything, because they're simply too young to do so. You know, a 4-year-old can't go get a tattoo in any state that I've heard of. Very young children can't even grasp the distinction between fantasy and reality. So if you tell a toddler that Batman isn't real, he'll just stare at you blankly because the phrase "isn't real" is empty in his mind. He doesn't know what you mean by that. Are we supposed to believe that people this ignorant and immature, so innocently detached from reality, can make meaningful declarations and decisions about their gender identity? A boy who says he's a girl doesn't even know what a girl is. He doesn't know anything. There was a viral Twitter thread last year that made this point very well, though unintentionally, I think. A podcaster named Jesse Thorne, in a thread that was liked and retweeted thousands of times by leftists who insisted that it was heartfelt and beautiful and, of course, stunning, he explains how he and his wife first discovered that their son was a girl. And we're told that this is a perfect explanation of the trans phenomenon among kids. Perfect explanation. And I completely agree, actually. So here's the story, just as a good example here. Good anecdote. Here's the story as he tells it. My daughter is 9. When she was born, we assumed she was a boy. We gave her a boy name, called her he. We gave her all kinds of toys. She generally preferred the ones our culture associates with boys, like building toys, trucks, and robots. She hated getting haircuts and always wanted her hair very long, like my wife's, but we just figured kids hate haircuts. She loved The Jungle Book, especially the part where Baloo the bear dresses up in a hula skirt, but what kid doesn't love that? When she started kindergarten, my wife was bathing her. An adult friend of ours had just come out as trans, and my wife mentioned that not all girls have vaginas and not all boys have penises. Our daughter asked, "Some girls have penises?" My wife said yes. Whether you were a boy or a girl wasn't about your private parts. "I'm a girl with a penis," my daughter said. All of a sudden, all these things that had confused us about her for so long now made sense. So let's review the process by which Jesse and his wife came to the conclusion that their little boy had a little girl mystically, spiritually, magically trapped inside of him. He says that his son hated getting haircuts and liked a scene in a movie where a bear wears a skirt. And that was enough to put him on this trajectory for the rest of his life. Now, even assuming that there's other evidence of the boy's girlness, which Jesse didn't mention, the fact that he mentions this, that this is presented at all, tells you everything you need to know. Unless you think that this is a straw man and, this is not the way it usually goes with parents of quote-unquote trans kids, no, I'm here to tell you that literally every story from a parent of a quote trans kid is exactly like this. It is always, "Oh, well, you know, when he was 2 years old, he liked playing with dolls." Now, the boy did also say that he's a girl with a penis, but he only said that after his mother told him that some girls have penises. If you tell a 5-year-old boy that some dragons are 3.5 feet tall and look a lot like 5-year-old boys, guess what? He's almost certain to inform you that he is just such a dragon. Because kids are highly suggestible. Again, they can't distinguish between fantasy and fiction. Fantasy and reality. A child at 5 can't be meaningfully accused of even telling a lie because he doesn't fully understand the difference between a lie and a truth. When my youngest son was 4, I remember going into the kitchen and finding a broken glass on the floor. And I asked my 4-year-old if he broke it. And over the course of this brief interrogation, he told me that he did break it, he didn't break it, it was already broken, it's not broken, his brother broke it, and the dog broke it. We didn't own a dog at the time, by the way. He did not have enough of a grasp on reality to deceive me effectively because he's just a small child, and everything that he says, every claim he makes, should be understood in that context. Now, the thread goes on to describe how the son socially transitioned, quote unquote, in kindergarten, Jesse's son, that is, and now at the age of 9, Jesse is thinking about what sorts of drugs he wants to put the child on. He also goes into detail about the Herculean efforts needed to protect his boy's parentally imposed delusions. It's all quite disturbing, but there's one moment of lucidity. Jesse reports this. "Anyway, she told us her new name, Grace. Actually, she initially said Greece, but we figured out what she meant. Not the clearest enunciator back then." Huh. Huh. Now, this is indeed the duty of a parent. Children say many things and often don't know what the words that they're using actually mean. They make claims that are not true. They express desires that are not really their desires. They announce plans that make no sense and attempt to do things that would get them killed or maimed if you were not to intercede. So it's your job as a parent to use your maturity and wisdom to guide your child and lead them through their own confusion. So Jesse heard his, quote, daughter say that, quote, she wanted to be called Greece. Jesse knows that Greece is a ridiculous name. Surely the boy can't actually want that name. And even if he does, it's for his own good that you guide him to a different name. A child at that age doesn't understand the significance of a name. He can't look ahead into the future and consider what it would be like to actually live with that name for the rest of your life. That's why we usually assign names to our kids. But it turns out that even the parents who let their children choose their names still don't really let them choose. There's a reason that out of all the trans kids, quote unquote, who are allowed to choose their own names and their own identities, have you noticed that none of them are now legally named Dragon Ninja or Pirate Bear or Awesome Cool Kid or any of the sorts of names and identities that a small child would actually choose for himself? Usually they end up with a simple and traditional name for the opposite gender or else something trendy and gender neutral that the parent gave them. The influence of the parents on these choices is evident. Now this is an interesting fact and it raises a question. If they won't let a child select any name he wants, then why would they let him select any gender he wants? If they wouldn't let their child be saddled by the ridiculous and immature name choice he made as a child, why are they allowing him to be saddled by the ridiculous and immature gender choice he made as a toddler? Doesn't make any sense at all. But children don't know that it makes no sense. They're not going to ask the kinds of skeptical questions that would expose this whole thing as a sham. And that's why the left wants to get to them young. That's why they'll defend their grooming and their indoctrination practices to the death, as we've seen down in Florida. The future of their ideology depends on getting to the kids and getting to them young, before they grow a little bit and their brains develop and they start to notice just how incoherent and insidious gender ideology really is. Though, to be fair, many adults in our country haven't even noticed this either. They've fallen prey to the confusion themselves, which, of course, is all by design. Confusion, in the end, is the name of the game. It's all they have. And that's why we have to counter it with clarity and with truth. And that's it for me. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to begin the Q&A portion. If you have a question for Mr. Walsh, please line up next to the man in the blue shirt back in the back wall. And we have our first question.
Hello, Matt. Thank you so much for coming on to the campus. My question for you is, with so many different leftist ideologies to focus on so much in the news, do you have any advice for staying focused on the issues that matter most?
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that we struggle with the most. I mean, I am always hesitant to be, usually I would not be accused of optimism, but I feel a slight tinges of optimism sometimes when I look at what's happening in the culture right now. And I think that we're actually making headway, especially when it comes to issues like this, cultural issues. I think the left's, when they came out explicitly against parental rights, when the Democrat Party basically made anti-parental rights into one of their platform things, that was a huge seminal moment. But I think you're right that a mistake that we can make is to get distracted by whatever shiny object over there. So I think in terms of issues that we should be focusing on, I think the issue of defending the realities of men and women, That to me is the central issue that we should be focused on. And we can actually win that. And the only way that we don't win it is if we allow ourselves to get distracted by something else. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your question?
Hi, Matt. My name is Cole. So I'm going to school to be an elementary teacher. And we have to read books about transgender kids. And it's just very brainwashy. So I'm wondering if you have any advice on what you would do in that situation.
Well, I would bring Johnny the Walrus into the kindergarten classroom. if I have to give another answer besides that, I would say, look, I think, first of all, to be a sane, decent person going into the public school environment, into the teaching profession, that is, you're doing the Lord's work, literally, and it takes a lot of heroism, so I applaud you for that. I also think, and this is definitely in the it's easy for me to say category, and it is easy for me to say, but it's also true that as a teacher, you simply cannot facilitate the sexual indoctrination of children, even if the school tells you that you have to. I think that's one of those times when this is what we need more teachers to do. Some have. We need more to say, I'm just not going to do it. Fire me, do what you're going to do, but I refuse to go along with it. So I think this is a line in the sand type of thing. Thank you.
Hello, Matt. My name is Talon. I feel very underdressed. Please forgive me for not wearing flannel. Ban me from the show if you must. But my question is, do you have any intention of discussing a convention of states on your show? It seems like there are issues like term limits or bills that are a gazillion pages long that those on the left and right who feel unrepresented by the federal government could achieve at the state level through a convention of states.
I agree with you. Do I have to say more? I mean, it's like I completely agree with you. I mean, this is maybe one of my kind of blind spots, actually, is that I zone in so carefully on the cultural issues that sometimes I can even neglect the political issues. I think you kind of need both of that. You need people that are really focusing on the political solutions, which is what you're talking about, and you need people focused on cultural issues. But that is I think one of the best potential political solutions that we could. You know, that we could hope for.
Thank you.
So thanks.
Hi, my name's Jacob. Recently, the President of the United States has made some statements on firearm policy in this country. I wanted to know what your opinion on that was.
Made statements on what policy?
Firearm policy.
Fire policy?
Firearm. Weapons, guns.
Guns, okay, fire. Oh, firearm policy, okay.
Yes.
I'm like, fire policy? I'm against fires? I mean, well, you have to be more specific on what he said. I don't know what specifically he said about gun rights. I can tell you right now, I disagree with it, whatever it is that he said.
Some of the things he's been talking about is banning 80% kits. He's appointing a new director to the ATF. He's also been talking about changing some of the rulings on stocks and pistol braces.
Yeah, I disagree with all that.
All right.
Like I said.
Hello, my name is Alex. I was curious about what relationship you have found between excess affluence and association with the LGBT, especially in the modern day period, as that is sort of a pattern throughout history.
I do think there's a really interesting correlation there. And we talk. I mentioned this generation over generation doubling of LGBT identification. And admittedly, I have not checked, but someone can fact check me on this. Someone could go to Snopes on this one, but I'm pretty sure that we're not going to find anything like this, you know, in Ethiopia or Kenya or, you know, something like that. This is very unique to the Western world, and that's especially the case when it comes to the trans identification in particular. I think that talking about gender ideology specifically, this is actually a really important point that we need to be making more, so I'm glad you brought it up, is that gender ideology is a product. It is a very insular, Western, modern thing. It's a product of our Western privilege. And if you go outside of modern Western affluent society, it's not just that they disagree with it, it's that they don't even understand what you're talking about, because their framework for life is completely, it's foreign to everything that they believe. And I actually know this for a fact, because in my film that's coming up, and I can't say a lot about it, but What Is a Woman's coming out soon, I actually did this. We tested this out, and we went to a third world country and talk to them about some of these issues, and you'll see what we discovered. But I think you're on to something anyway.
Simon, I have a specific question. So being that this is a billion-dollar industry, that as you yourself mentioned, there are pharmaceutical companies that make billions off of this. Would it not be in the best interest to use the long arm of the federal government against these companies? For instance, they engage in price fixing. Why not use the Clayton Antitrust Act to break them up? Also, why not take away their research grants, take away their tax breaks? Make it so it is no longer, you know, something they can make easy money off of.
I love it. I'm on board for all that. I think, and it's not just with what they're doing, you know, drugging and chemically castrating kids. I think the pharmaceutical industry has. Here's another law that I would support is, you know, I would support a ban on direct-to-consumer advertisements. I don't think that there should be advertisements where the pharmaceutical company could put these ads out and say, you might have this disease, and if you do, here's a drug for it. Go talk to your doctor about that. That's not the way that's supposed to work. It's supposed to be you have symptoms and something's going wrong in your body. You go to your doctor and talk to them about it, and they're supposed to help you figure out what drug you need. You don't go to the doctor already having the drug in mind that you want. And this is another thing that outside of, you know, this is a relatively new modern phenomenon. And so that's another law that I think we should put in place to tamp down on the pharmaceutical industry. Yep.
Hey, Matt, I'm Jack. So certainly with your book and your film coming out, we've talked a lot about social media, entertainment, all that. What are the further steps that can be taken? Because clearly the left are involved in all those areas. What are some more steps that can be taken so that the right can kind of find themselves a space in that? That's not cliche in a sort of way.
Taken with respect to big tech?
Yeah, with big tech, I mean, Twitter, social media, just entertainment in general, that sphere that's just been so heavily dominated by the left in recent years.
Well, one thing, I guess we need more eccentric billionaires to come in and buy some of these companies. Unfortunately, there's only one that's any good. So I tell you, there's a few things. I mean, it's kind of two different issues. You've got entertainment, you've got social media. When it comes to social media, one of the reasons why I'm so happy about the Elon Musk news, aside from just how angry it makes the left and how hilarious it is, is that I've never been in favor of this kind of this idea of like, well, let's go off and have our own social media platform. And we've seen a lot of it's a noble experiment, I suppose. It's maybe worth a try, but then what we're doing is we're taking our voice and we're putting it over on this platform that can simply be ignored and it has no cultural purchase whatsoever. And so I think we need to stay in the mix. We need to stay involved. And I would say the same in entertainment, internet. I mean, I understand the temptation to just take your ball and go home, to go run off into the woods somewhere and, you know, live in a cabin. That's actually maybe not a bad idea, but if you're not gonna do that, then I think we have to stay involved in the culture and figure out ways within these systems to sometimes even use the system against itself. That's, in a small way, that's something we were able to do with Johnny the Walrus. And again, it's a small example, but it's, you know, rather than taking this book and saying, well, we're not gonna sell it on Amazon at all. No, I'd rather use Amazon. I know Amazon doesn't want this book on their platform, but I wanna use it against them and against their own agenda and their own message. And so I think that's kind of what we should be doing. Thanks.
Hey, Matt. Greetings from Minnesota, SBG for life. I just want to know, I've been talking to some of the people I graduated college with about money and billionaires, especially you mentioned Elon Musk, that's come up a lot. I was just curious because I hadn't heard a lot of it on the Daily Wire or anybody else watch your show the most, but what are your thoughts on, like, because I find myself as a conservative oftentimes arguing on the side of billionaires. But like, I'm not necessarily like pro billionaire, but like, because some of them done kind of bad things. But economically, what is your thoughts on that? Like, where, you know, obviously Elon Musk is doing kind of some great things on with the Twitter side and free speech. But like, how would you engage that in some of those conversations?
You have to be a little bit more specific. So like, what do you mean exactly?
Like, economically and economic policy. Let me put it to you this way. A lot of my friends hate billionaires.
Yeah.
Just straight up hate them. And so, like, as it's like, well, they, you know, the earn the money, that side of it. What would you say, like, as a conservative, to what point are we not just saying, oh, we love all billionaires, we want billionaires and all that kind of thing, and but where's the kind of the middle of the road?
Right, okay. Yeah, I don't think defending billionaires is exactly, that's kind of the argument that they want to have. Is, are you pro or anti-billionaire? That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't wake up every day thinking about how much I love billionaires and I want to defend billionaires. I mean, they're billionaires. They're doing a fine job of defending themselves. And it just so happens that most of them, on a personal level, I just hate because of who they are and what they stand for. Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, like, I hate those guys. And it's not even because of their money, just makes it worse because it gives them more power. What I would say is I'm not pro or anti-billionaire. I am in favor of economic freedom. That's what I'm in favor of. And if you have that, then you're going to end up with some billionaires. And if you want to look at that as a necessary evil or whatever you want to call it, I'm fine with that categorization. The other issue also is, someone is going to have the money. Like Jeff Bezos got a lot of money. And if we want to take that money from him, well, the only other option, the only other force out there that could take it for themselves would be the government. And so do I trust the government more than I trust Jeff Bezos? I don't trust either of them, really. But that's why I just fall on the side of economic freedom, you know, at the end of the day.
Hi, Matt. My name's Ellie, and I attend a pretty liberal community college in Duluth, Minnesota. And in the gender phenomenon and all the pronouns and stuff, that's really pushed there. So I was wondering how you would recommend, defending against that, and while you're at the college, pushing against it.
The first thing, the most important thing, is just on a personal level, to stave off the temptation to just go along with it, because you don't want to be confrontational, you don't want to hurt people's feelings, you don't want to cause problems for yourself. I mean, all of that is like, it's an understandable inclination. But part of the way that we got into this position in our culture is that's what almost all of the sane people have done. They just like, well, I don't feel like having this argument, so I'm just not going to do it. And so if you can stave that off, and it doesn't mean you have to go up and you find a trans person, start screaming at them or screaming their biologically correct pronouns at them. No, it's just, I'm going to live my life as a person. I'm going to live in the truth as a person grounded in truth, and I'm not going to compromise that for you. So that's a personal level. And then on a kind of broader level, I think, and this is something that we see on a lot of campuses, including this one, but it's also really important, is to organize, is to find, because you're not, you might feel like you're the only sane person, but this is one thing that I've learned over the last few years also, is that, you know, there was a time when I thought that I was basically alone, and then I go out and I meet people, and it's, no, we're out there. It's just that we're not nearly as good at organizing as the left is. And so I would say organize is the other thing, too. Thanks.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for coming today. So the one thing that I really took from you speaking today is the language piece of it, and how they're manipulating the language and how they're really like abandoning proper language. And so my question to you is, in the education piece of all of this, why do we see the English professors, teachers being the ones that are pushing this agenda the most, when language is, like, proper language is being abandoned?
Yeah, well, you're right. The answer is that a lot of them are left-wing ideologues, first of all, because they're in the education system. And then a lot of the rest of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are also cowards. And they know that this is wrong, but it's just, again, it's the same story we talked about before. And one of the ways, by the way, that we ended up with a lot of left-wing ideologues in the public school system, teaching English and every other subject, is that, they're filtering out of college. And so this is one thing that for so long, and I was guilty of this too, conservatives, we would look at all the purple-haired, you know, lefties on college campuses, and we would kind of laugh, and we would say, oh, they're gonna go out into the real world, and they're gonna have a wake-up call, and they got something really in store for them. And it turns out that no, we were the ones who needed the wake-up call. because they went out into the real world and became public school teachers. You know, they changed the world to suit their needs. They didn't change for the world like we all thought they would. And so there's this kind of like self-perpetuating cycle in the education system, which is how you end up with that, I think.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be the last question of the evening.
So make it good. Pressure's on.
I just wanted to say I don't actually have a question, but somebody brought up the Convention of States, and I brought a gift for you. It's a book called Consent of the Governed, and it's a different solution other than the Convention of States, so I just wanted to pass that along to this gentleman who can get it to you.
We end on a gift. I kind of like that. I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.